Hello, everyone. Dana Louise Williams here. I am your host for this free interview series called Rewired for Success. And this is an invitation to go deeper into your purpose, passion, and prosperity. Our mission is to help you step into a deeper way of thinking and being in the world. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Larry Dossey, and it's my absolute pleasure to introduce you to him and his work today. But first I'll give you a little introduction to his work and what he's been up to. Dr. Larry Dossey is an internal medicine physician, former chief of staff of Medical City Dallas Hospital, and former co-chairman of the panel on mind-body interventions, National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, National Institutes of Health. He is an executive editor of the peer-reviewed journal Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing. He is the author of 12 books on the role of consciousness and spirituality in health, which have been translated into languages around the world. His most recent book is One Mind: How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. He lectures around the world. Welcome, Dr. Larry.
Dana, it's great to be on your show, and I thank you for having me.
Well, it's my absolute pleasure. And I just wanted to share with our listeners, I was reading about your book, and I had some time before our interview today, and I got so immersed in it that I was late for our call. I could not pull myself out of it. It's just amazing material that you have brought forward for us in your book, One Mind, and I would love for you to just tell us about the premise and whatever you want to tell us, just dive in.
Well, great. I appreciate it. Well, the book is about how our minds are connected and how there really are no limits or boundaries to our minds. And if this is so, then in some way we are all connected through what I call the universal mind or the one mind, thus the title of the book. The evidence for this, I think, is just overwhelming. It comes as a shock to a lot of people to talk this way, however, because we all have this sense of individuality and personhood, which is really important and is certainly one side of consciousness, but that just doesn't go far enough. It doesn't account for how we can share thoughts at a distance, how we can exchange information over arbitrary distances, how we can even sense the future, and basically how our minds just simply will not stay put in the present or in our own skulls.
Mm-hmm.
So in the book, it's just full of people's stories and personal experiences of how this manifests in our life. And also it's about the empirical evidence that has just really poured forth in the past few years, showing that there are just no boundaries or limits to the mind.
Mm-hmm. And what you talk about just a moment ago of how our minds bounce around, are our minds searching for one mind by constantly tracking and bouncing around?
Well, I think that's one way to put it. I think that there is an urge in the human race for connectedness. Nature did not design us to be alone, and we're never at our best than when we are connected and feel a sense of unity and connectedness with other people. I think that this is our natural state, this communitarian or unitary way of thinking about ourselves. The evidence clearly shows, in my judgment, that we are healthier, we are wiser, and we have a great sense of fulfillment and purpose in life if we can maximize our sense of unity and oneness with each other. So I think there are a lot of reasons why we ought to pay attention to this. You know, in our culture, however, we really don't emphasize this. Particularly in the United States, we've made a fetish and obsession about this thing of individuality Everyone is supposed to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and honor individuality above all. But I just think that misses something inherently valuable about who we are. I'm all for individuality and personhood. That's not to be denied. But I think we just underestimate who we are and what we can be if we don't pay attention to the unitary aspect of who we are. I'm sitting here in a thunderstorm. If you hear lightning and thunder crashing.
Oh, wow. That's kind of neat. I love lightning and thunderstorms. Hopefully we don't get disconnected.
Really?
Well, one thing that I noticed that you had said, that quote, you know, about ourselves, about the ego, you know, taking care of ourselves, but we should flip that statement and take care of others as if we were one and if they were ourselves. And you talk about that story at the beginning of your book with the fellow that was saving the person in the subway.
Yeah.
Can you speak about that?
Yes, this took place about 5 years ago, and it had to do with an African-American man who was standing on a subway platform in New York City, and he saw a young man in his 20s having an epileptic fit, and the poor young man fell off the subway platform onto the tracks. And without thinking, the black man, Wesley Autry, who was a 50-year-old construction worker, jumped off the subway platform onto the tracks to try to rescue this young man and get him back on the platform. He couldn't do it, however, and he saw a train coming. And without thinking, he positioned this young man between the subway train rails and covered him with his body. He was almost beheaded. The train could not stop in time, and he was so close to the undercarriage of the train that his cap was smeared with oil from the train itself. Mm. But when the train did manage to stop after three cars had passed over them, he was able to get the young man out from under the train and to a hospital. When the press descended on this man, and overnight he was actually famous. He appeared on almost all the early morning television shows within the week. People asked him why he did this, and he said that, well, he didn't think it was anything special. It was just something that needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And this actually fascinated me, and I included this in the book because people have wrestled with this idea of why one person will risk their life to save another one. One of the people who wrote about this was the great mythologist, Joseph Campbell. Mm-hmm. And Campbell's explanation for this was that at the decisive moment, the rescuer is so identified with the person in need that he really isn't rescuing the individual, he's rescuing himself, because their minds have so totally fused and become so connected and unified that they've essentially become a common consciousness. I was just struck by this because when I was in Vietnam as a battalion surgeon out in the field, as I explain in the book, I had occasion to be in this position of putting my life on the line to save other young men in need. And I had no idea why I did this, because before I went to Vietnam, I swore that I would never take chances out of respect for my family and people who cared for me. And when I came back from Vietnam, I was really disturbed by that. I even began to doubt my own sanity. And I will never forget when I came across Campbell's writing about how at that moment the two minds come together and function as one. And when I read that, I just had this an epiphany of just realizing that that was what compelled me to take those chances with these young men who were in great danger. and put my life on the line for them. I knew that that was a perfect explanation for what I had experienced. Mm. And so it was really something of a spiritual experience for me. And it was one of the earliest examples that were really meaningful to me personally about this idea and possibility of a common consciousness that unites all of us.
Mm. And you talk about how animals, you know, humans will put their life on the line for animals. Animals will put their life on the line for humans, and even animals for other animals and other species. And can you talk about that and how it fits in with what you just told us?
Well, I think that there's no evidence that consciousness is confined to human beings. I don't think this would be shocking to a pet owner who feel connected consciously often with mm-hmm. animals they love, of all species, horses, cats, dogs, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, we see animals risking their lives commonly to save people. As you just said, we will risk our life to save animals, and this occurs in every possible combination. So what I think is going on is that we really are so unified across species even that we will risk our lives to save those things that we love, whether or not there's another person or an animal that is really close to us. And you know, what I find astonishing too is that you don't really have to know another person in order to put your life on the line for them. This was mm-hmm. the lesson in the subway story where Wesley Autry, the black man, mm-hmm. Risked his life to save this young white man whom he had never seen in his life and knew nothing about. I think that's the one mind coming into play and manifesting in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that kind of energy and that kind of understanding is such an important conversation, because it just opens up an expanded version of love and oneness for everyone to,
and compassion and empathy.
Yeah,
and you know,
and
one reason.
About,
go ahead.
Well, you talk about being in service, right? And if we, you know, if we're just a spontaneous energies that are ready to be in service when that moment arises, we wouldn't even think about it. We would just, like your story with the fellow in the subway station, we would just act.
Well, that's right. You know, it's instinctive. It's built in. It's almost a reflex. One of the reasons I am fascinated by this whole idea is that I'm an identical twin, and all of my life, my twin brother and I have had these kinds of shared experiences, even though we're very far apart. Sometimes it would be a sharing of thoughts and feelings, and sometimes even physical symptoms between us would be shared simultaneously at the same moment. And besides that, I happen to be married to a twin. My wife, Barbara, who's a cardiovascular nurse and an author, has had shared experiences with her twin brother hundreds and hundreds of miles apart, sheer physical symptoms, pain, for example, in a certain part of the body. When one was affected, the other would feel it. So our household has been a kind of a twin laboratory over the years where all sorts of weird stuff
that is amazing
would happen, yeah. Pretty amazing.
I could see where you would naturally be drawn to, you know, the energetic connections that other people might not be aware of. I want to just share something with you that's going to happen in about 2 minutes. We're just coming up to the top of the hour. I have been doing this thing for a couple years now. I have a chiming clock in my office, and it has a swinging gold wand on it. It's a pendulum chime clock. And I see a divine six-pointed triangle star, and I put a prayer into the center of the chime, and I invite my clients, if they're here in my office when it goes off, I invite them to put a prayer in. And then I extended it out to a prayer for all, every human and every life form on the planet. And then I connected it up to all the chiming clocks around the world that go off at that same moment.
Oh, wow.
So that every hour on the hour, we're getting a prayer 24/7, 7 days a week. And my prayer that I really pray, that I love, that I put in there once and it just keeps emulating, is that I am directly connected with Creator and that God's got my back. So
that's beautiful.
In a minute, it's going to go off, and it would be really nice for us to put a little prayer in there. With the work that you do and all this beautiful connected research, your energy would be so welcome to go out to the planet for all that you do.
Oh, thank you. That's great.
So I'm just going to be quiet for a moment, and you can go ahead and put your prayer in there when this goes off. Okay. Just went all the way around the world.
Well, that's beautiful. It's a beautiful chime, by the way.
Thank you. So let's get back to this business of you and your twins. And I just think that is such a miracle. I've always been I have to stop whatever I'm doing if I see a set of twins, and I'm in awe.
Well, so am I, actually, and I'll just relate a twin story to you that's in the book, which will give people an idea about how powerful these connections actually are. One twin story I talk about is 4-year-old identical twin girls. This story came from a town in Spain. And they were so identical. They had shared feelings in very strange ways all of their life. And but this one sort of took the cake. One day, the father took one of the little twin girls off to visit the grandparents. And the grandparents were tens of miles away. But the other little girl wanted to stay home and help her mother with chores. Unfortunately, while she was doing so, she touched a red-hot iron and erupted in a large second-degree burn, a blister, a big, fat blister on one of her hands. And as it turned out, at the same time, tens of miles away at the grandparents' house, the other twin girl erupted in a second-degree burn, a huge blister, on the same hand, on the same part of the hand, through no obvious reason.
Mm-hmm.
This little girl was taken to the doctor, and photographs were made of this, so there's a medical record of it. So it was very well documented. But this is one of those spectacular examples that there's something strange that connects people across great distances, because there's no theory in the world about how this could have happened naturally without some sort of connectivity between these distant twins. And you see this in the literature. There are even books on these connections between twins. And what seems to put this in motion is emotional bondedness and emotional connectedness. There are twins who are not very close with each other, who have problems of individuation and ego development, who don't want to be alike or connected and so on. So you don't see these kinds of phenomena very much in those kinds of relationships between twins.
Mm-hmm.
But anytime there's an emotional bond, a feeling of love and real heart connectedness between people, then these things are likely to occur. And they certainly occur more frequently in twins, but you don't have to be a twin to experience these things. I have a file cabinet of stories that people have shared with me about telepathic exchanges and clairvoyance and all sorts of shared incidents between people who are lovers, who our parents and children who are extremely close, and so on. So bondedness and emotional connectedness and love seems to catalyze and make possible these sorts of exchanges.
Mm-hmm. I recently read the book that Anita Moriarty wrote, Dying to Be Me, where she's all her major organs have shut down, and she can hear what the doctors are saying at the end of the hallway. She knows what her brother's thinking as he's flying in a plane across, you know, the other side of the world to come and get there before she dies.
Yeah.
And she comes back into her body, and you know, after experiencing, you know, her complete death, and I know that you have a chapter about that as well in your book. Do you want to share with us your thoughts on that?
Well, I have a chapter called Near-Death Experiences, and the reason that's in there is that when people undergo a near-death experience, they come back with a transformed way of looking at life.
Mm-hmm.
And these are profound transformations. And the commonest thing that people say about what their experience was like is that they had this profound sense that everything was one. Everything is connected to everything at this level of knowing. And so because they sense their oneness and connectedness with everything, all sentient creatures, they have a reverence for life.
Mm-hmm.
When they return. And this is not just lip service. These people never see the world as disconnected. They always are attuned to this oneness and unity that they believe that they have sensed that a level which they just simply didn't know about before.
Mm-hmm.
I think this level of connectedness and unity and oneness is one of the great gifts that this near-death experience has for people. And this is not an unusual sort of thing. There are now judged to be 15 million Americans who have had near-death experiences.
Mm.
And I think they're far more common than we used to believe. You know, Raymond Moody wrote the book Life After Life about 40 years ago. And before that time, people just didn't share these things because there was a stigma attached to talking like that and expressing those experiences. But now, you know, this is out of the closet, and we're just beginning to realize how common this is among, you know, ordinary folks.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also talk about premonitions, and you've had your own experiences about, you know, up and above all the documented information, you've had your own experiences.
Well, I have, and I must say it was very unnerving when I did. It happened in my first year of internal medicine practice in Texas, and I had a series of what are called precognitive dreams in which I could see things that happened in great detail before they occurred. I just was shocked by this because I knew the world couldn't possibly work like that. You couldn't know things days ahead of time before they even happened, but there it was. And I actually wrote a book about premonitions because I was so fascinated by this personal experience that I began to look at the research that has been done in this field. And there's no doubt, based upon careful studies and experiments that have been done by researchers all over the world by now, that we have the ability to know the future up to days before it happens. There's a whole series of experiments called remote viewing in which
mm-hmm.
one person tries to send another person who may be on the other side of the earth detailed information by just thinking about it and visualizing it. And the thing about these hundreds of experiments that have been done by now, the receiver who's trying to connect with the message that's being sent, the receiver actually receives the message up to a week before the sender even sends it.
Hmm.
So this is experimental proof. These studies have been done at Princeton and Princeton University and many other institutions around the world. There's just simply no doubt that minds can connect across great distances as if they're one, And they can even connect outside of the present moment, which these experiments clearly show. So I'm proud to present this sort of information in the book as, I think, hard evidence that minds are connected, that there really aren't any limits and boundaries to the mind, and this just shows that minds can come together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the thing I think that we should be asking ourselves is how we can help that happen and get outside of this sense of isolation and disconnection that is really wounding to a lot of people in our culture now.
And what for our listeners on the call, what could we do to just silence that ego and broaden our collective unity of thinking?
Well, I think there are a lot of ways that we can sort of set the stage so that this sense of oneness and unity can unfold in our lives. If you had to select one method or technique to help bring this into being, it would have to be some sort of contemplative practice, whether we call that meditation or prayer or just sitting down, shutting up, and turning our smartphones off and just paying attention and listening to what the world will reveal to us. If you look at people who are really good at these experiments that I've just mentioned, most of them have some sort of meditative practice in their life. There's nothing magic about meditation. This comes to people in dreams as well. But the common thread through all of the techniques to help this sense of unity unfold is sitting down and allowing information to bubble up from sources that we usually just shut off from the deep unconscious. That's why I think dreams are such a potent pathway to this realization of oneness and unity. So simply learning to pay attention to what unfolds and emerges from our unconscious is one of the great, great ways of doing this. But that's certainly not the only way. I know a lot of people who have epiphanies or sudden revelations of this oneness and unity on exposure to great beauty through, for example, listening to majestic music or viewing great art, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I find one of the most potent ways for myself is exposure to nature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
My wife and I every year go up into the Rocky Mountains somewhere and just camp in the deep wilderness alone for a couple of weeks. This is the most potent way I have found to enter this kind of knowing space where one senses one's oneness and unity with mm-hmm. with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, this knowledge is this possibility is inherent in really everybody, and I wouldn't want to make it anything special, because I think this is an intrinsic form of knowing that will express itself if we will just put our egos out of the way.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk in your book about how God is in everything, and if God is in everything, God's in us.
Well, I think that's right. This is not a radical revelation. This idea of the God within is an absolute ancient piece of spiritual wisdom that really is at home in most mystical traditions that have ever existed. This sense of oneness with the supreme being or the absolute, whatever term we give to that, whether it's God or goddess or Allah or something else. But it's a central key portion to every respectable spiritual tradition that I know anything about.
Yes, and I'm just having a fantasy here that if everybody was aware of the God within, every single person on the planet, then it would be really hard for them to be violent with another person if they knew that that unity encumbered themselves as well.
Well, I think that's a key insight, and I'm glad you brought it up. I talk about in the book, that if we really, truly realize their oneness and connectedness with the Absolute, and how there is the divinity within each of us, then this would open doors for empathy and compassion to other people, and not just other people, but toward all sentient life on Earth. I've even suggested in the book that, based on our true connectedness with one another, that we revise the golden rule from "do unto others as you would have them do unto you" to something like "be compassionate to others and be kind to others, because in some sense they are you."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this realization of connectedness really is a potent force for unleashing love, unrestrained, unmitigated love for all of life on Earth. I think our future may depend on the degree to which we can love and be compassionate toward sentient life on Earth, because we're wrecking our environment, because we feel cut off from it, and because we think that we can secede from nature and function as an isolated being. And I just think that that sets the stage for all sorts of environmental degradation and greed and selfishness that really threatens to destroy this beautiful Earth that we inhabit.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that we get sidetracked with is the idea, what you just talked about, for me, that is the ultimate prosperity. The ultimate prosperity is oneness. That's a richness that money cannot touch.
Absolutely.
And what's happening is we've kind of missed something somewhere along the way, that we think that the idea of prosperity is money.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I think that you're right on target. This is so important. You know, if we lose the environment, it's not going to make any difference how many homes you have, or whether you have a home in Paris and London, and how many swimming pools and all of this this kind of business. The health of the Earth is just the ultimate concern, or should be, for everyone, because nothing else matters if we lose the only home we have.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, how do we behave in a more responsible manner that honors the Earth? I always fall back on a wonderful comment by the brilliant novelist Alice Walker, who said, "Anything we love can be saved." And so the question is, do we love the Earth enough to change our behaviors in order to save not the Earth? The Earth will be fine, it will endure, but what we're talking about is our own skin. You know, it's, are we going to be around in any meaningful way to enjoy this incredible planet that we inhabit? And I think this notion of oneness and unity with all of sentient life is absolutely necessary if we're going to be successful as a species.
Right, and having wars and fighting over oil and, you know, huge, huge corporations constantly striving to chase, you know, more money. It parallels to me is your story with the man that put his life on the line in the subway. If some of these corporations could put their, you know, strategies on the line and pay it forward and change it up, wouldn't that just be a beautiful thing?
Well, it would be a beautiful thing. And I happen to think that this awareness of that we're all in it together and it's impossible to secede from nature and get away with it, I think the awareness of this is increasing. And I think, however, having said that there is urgency to get on with this, because I don't think time is on our side here. I don't think we have another couple of hundred years to rape and pillage the Earth as we have in the since the Industrial Revolution began about 300 years ago. I think that there is urgency to this, and I think that this is widely perceived by an increasing number of people
mm-hmm.
that we need to get with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine, you know, that most people who are listening to this program don't need this lesson. The people who need it are the corporations that are abusing this great earth, and they're the people that we need to be speaking to.
Mm-hmm. And the ripple effect of people that are listening to, you know, the scientists and you know, the Greg Bradens and the Dr. Larry Dossies of the world, the ripple effect is getting those that are listening stronger so that they can speak their truth and they can emulate that truth to the point where the people that are, you know, the pharmaceutical industries and the corporations that are, you know, in control and maneuvering the information that we can and cannot receive about what's really happening. I truly believe, like what you say, there is a higher awareness now, and the first step to any kind of healing or any kind of change is awareness.
Absolutely. And I would like to say this to the listeners. You know, I think we underestimate ourselves about our power and influence in bringing about global change. It's not necessary for us to convince a majority that these changes are necessary. I used to really misunderstand this. I mean, for example, I recall thinking and wondering about how the Renaissance happened in Italy. And I used to think that, well, surely at least 51% of Italians came around to this new way of thinking and being. And so this change happened because the majority of people adopted a new worldview and perspective. It wasn't like that. Historians now know that only just a few families were converted to this way of thinking, and then the whole thing rippled and changed and echoed through Italy and eventually all of Europe. So there have been studies done now that which address the question, how many people need to change for this for a dramatic transition to occur in a country. And it's something like 10 to 20%. It isn't 50, 51%.
Mm. Nice.
And so we don't have to bring everyone or even a majority over to our way of being and thinking and feeling.
Mm-hmm.
We need to take our own stand and work on our own issues and change our behaviors. And we will get there, and we will get there without having to bring, as I just mentioned, the majority of people over.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this can be empowering because,
yes.
It lightens their load, you know, and it helps people speak truth to power.
I love what you said. You know, a bunch of years ago, I had the pleasure of being in a workshop with Carolyn Mace and Dr. Norm Shealy. And Carolyn said something that I'll never forget. It really, really affected me. And she said, you know, in 100 years from now, the people that are on the planet are going to look at this time in history, and it's going to be called the Healing Renaissance.
That's lovely. Wow.
And that's kind of what you just talked about. Like, you know, even though there's just, you know, whatever the percentage is below the 51% mark, that doesn't matter. We can still make a difference.
Well, that's right. And it's easy to feel disempowered because, you know, all we have to do is look around us, as you've already mentioned, and see the selfishness and greed that's being perpetrated in our culture by huge corporations who just really don't care about the after effects. But I agree with Carolyn. I mean, I think that this there is a healing revolution going on, and I imagine that most people who are listening to this program are part of that.
Well, really, you know, it's a perfect example of it is people that are having amazing, miraculous healings outside of traditional medicine.
Well, it's true, and I actually am fascinated by those sorts of healings and have made a study of them. And they're much more common than people in my profession of medicine realize. I was told when I was in medical school that you will never see a miracle healing, so-called, in your life as a doctor because they're just too rare. This is simply not true, and I'm happy it isn't. There is one book now called Spontaneous Remissions that goes into thousands of cases in just about every disease you can imagine, which have simply occurred with no treatment at all, or treatment that was just totally inadequate to explain the healing. I have a file of cases like this that people have sent me. You know, it just, some of them are so magical and wonderful that they just make the hair stand on end. But you're right. They are more common than people realize.
Exactly. And so, you know, like we do have a choice. There's a duality. We can, you know, you talk about the one side of the coin or the other side of the coin in your book. And, you know, it's a choice to go to, oh, there's so much destruction or, oh, there's so much disease or, well, yeah, but there's the other side of the coin that is the complete, you know, polar opposite of that.
Well, it's what I call a complementarity. Each side complements the other, and it takes both of them to be a whole.
Well, we can't have the tides. We can't have the sunrise without the polarity, without the duality. We have, you know, it's a pulse, right? But I think what happens is people get apathetic, and they go, you know, they get kind of sucked down the rabbit hole into the lower vibration. And they don't recognize that it's a dance.
Well, it is a dance. I wrote a book about the power of the power of prayer and its role in healing and in modern medicine a few years ago. A book called Healing Words, and there are now over a couple dozen major control randomized clinical studies showing that people's thoughts at a distance can change the physiology of someone else. Whether or not you call these intentions or wishes, or whether you call them prayer, and these changes can be documented not just in people but in animals, which is very important because if they occur in animals, you just can't say it happened according to positive thinking or the placebo response because as far as we know, animals don't think positively or negatively. And so these studies clearly show that if you're sick, you don't have to do it all by yourself to get well. I can help you through sending compassionate, loving wishes, wantings, or prayers, or again, whatever term appeals to us. And so there's a mutuality going on here. You can help me. I can help you. Nobody has to carry the whole load themselves. And this is just another manifestation of the oneness of consciousness.
Mm.
Thoughts can blend together at a distance. We can come to each other's aid.
Mm-hmm. And something that's just coming up for me, those people that you talk about that have had near-death experiences that did not have the sense of unity until after they had a near-death experience.
Yep.
Those folks that come back into the world and show us that beautiful verve for life that they have, if it is an intelligent universe and the people that haven't woken up yet to knowing that oneness in their hearts, then it's all part of the plan for us to have the adventure of making the choice to wake up and dance in the energy of the oneness.
That's beautifully expressed. And you know, one of the things that they come back with also, these near-death experiencers, is the certainty of immortality.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about that? Ooh, I love that subject.
Well, I have a chapter in the book on the subject of immortality, and the way I get there is, first of all, through people's actual experiences who have had the near-death journey. They all come back with the certainty of immortality. But also it's implied by the evidence for our connectedness with one another through space and time. The evidence, as I explain in the book, is that we're not isolated to particular points in time. We're not stuck in the present. We're infinite in time. These are the implications of the actual experiments. So what's being infinite in time? Well, being infinite in time is just another word for eternality and immortality. It's being infinite in time, which simply is a way of saying that there's some soul-like aspect of who we are that couldn't die if it tried, even though the body perishes. So the implications of the oneness and connectedness of consciousness, the fact that it has no limits in space or time, points like an arrow toward immortality. And so this is not just philosophical meandering. People affirm this, as we've mentioned, who come back having nearly died. And that certainty never goes away. One thing that does go away, however, is the fear of death. These people are really not fearful of death after having looked it in the face. One of the great stories now that's been on the New York Times list for some time is Dr. Eben Alexander's book, Proof of Heaven. He was a Harvard-trained neurosurgeon who almost died. They almost unhooked him from the breathing machines when he had a severe case of meningitis. But he came back with a story to tell which just curls your hair. And I would recommend that to everyone listening.
Yes,
who
definitely.
Really wants to know what...
I want to get my hair curled.
You like curly hair? That's one way to get it without having a perm. So check out that book, Dr. Eben Alexander, Proof of Heaven. Actually, he and I are doing a conference together at the Omega Institute this coming November, so people could come and hear us talk about these things if they're interested.
Oh, fantastic. What, something that's coming up for me, just on that same note, Dr. Larry, and it comes back to that idea of the intelligence of the universe, and there's nothing is random. So if we are tapped with the wand of amnesia when we decide to come back to Earth school again, then the fact that we are not aware of our oneness yet is all part of God's plan. So we don't have to fight with it to get it. It's perfection as it's unfolding.
Well, that's a beautiful way to express it, I think, and I agree wholly with you. One nifty aspect of this idea of interconnected minds outside the present even suggests that there is a source of information out there that we can contact, which is all-wise to our benefit. There have been people who have been highly successful in doing this. One of them is the great inventor Thomas Edison, who I talk about in the book. He said once that I've never invented anything, which is kind of surprising coming from one of the world's greatest inventors who ever lived. But he went on to explain. He said, I get ideas from the outside. He said, I get ideas from the universe. They do not come from me. And so here's a man who left an unambiguous statement that he had the ability to access a source of wisdom which was not internal to himself. I think a lot of this goes on. Some of the great scientists who have come out with some of the most astonishing revelations in the 20th century were very clear about this idea of the one mind. One that I talk about in the book is a hero of mine, Erwin Schrödinger, who was a Nobel Prize winner in physics, who just flat out said that there is only one mind. And he was clear that many of the great scientists got their information not from logic or analysis or even experiments, but tapping into something outside themselves, which is, I think, a collective expression of the one mind.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's just such a fantastic, juicy subject, you know, and I love that we are eternal beings and that we can tap into that timeless nature of infinity to embrace the fact that we don't know who we are. We're in a trance of who we think we are, and we kind of hypnotize ourselves every day when we reinvent our limitations.
Well, I'm glad you used the word hypnosis, because I think that there is a cultural hypnosis, a collective hypnosis that we've bought into, which says that, you know, we're cut off from each other, we're isolated, and we're individual. That's really unfortunate. I think historically we'll look back and say that this was a period where we took a wrong turn in human experience and human thinking. We emphasized individuality to the detriment of the unitary collective part of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our future is going to depend on how we get back on track in honoring that level of connectedness between all of us.
Mm-hmm. I'm a hypnotherapist, and I get a lot of people that come and they want me to hypnotize them so that they don't have certain things going on. And I always tell them, well, I'm not going to lay another trance over top of an old trance. I'm going to go and look at the trance that's sitting underneath you or underneath your goal of what you want that is, it's calling out to you. It's asking you to please give me a new download. And it can only talk through the information of the disconnect or of the incongruence. So, you know, if all the things that are going on the planet that are calling out to us are just calling out to the lighter-minded people, please hear the call of, you know, what the planet is showing us, we just have to pick up the phone.
Yes. And listen, yes, I think the Earth is speaking to us. A favorite author of mine, Arundhati Roy, said once, and I'm quoting her, another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a woman who developed the capacity to listen to what the Earth is saying, and the Earth is speaking and will speak to anyone who has the courage to open up and listen.
Mm. That's beautiful. And it's almost like it's a hologram, right? There's a hologram right now present. And I don't know if you've ever thought this way before, Dr. Larry, but I believe that the planet will be here. The planet's going to survive. The planet will always reinvent itself. We're the ones that have to change.
Well, that's exactly right. I hear people all the time say, you know, we have to save the planet. The planet will do just fine. It would probably do better without our being around. But frankly, this is the best planet I've ever been on, and I love it and would like to see humans have a home there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that our future on this planet depends on whether or not we can actualize and manifest this sense of oneness with all sentient life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unless we do, we're not going to care enough to make the changes that are necessary to survive. So my message to people is open up to the sense of oneness and unity. Otherwise, it will be highly unlikely that we can find the creativity and the courage to make the changes that are going to be necessary for our own survival,
mm-hmm.
not the survival of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you think of the planet like a human, and the blood vessels, instead of being blood vessels, are bodies of water. There, you know, there's the heart ventricles, there's rivers, there's, you know, all kinds of things happening. You know, people that have a serious illness and they say, well, we have to fight cancer, mm-hmm. that it's kind of the wrong approach. So if the planet, where it's showing disharmony and disease because of what mankind, you know, because of what we've all done collectively, we're all part of what's happening to the planet. So the planet's just showing us what we have to clean up.
No, that's exactly right. And I think those metaphors are very powerful. The Earth has an immune system just like a human body does. And in our instance, at the human level, our body will throw off things that are injurious to it. And we should be careful because the immune system of the Earth may turn on us
mm-hmm.
because we're the biggest threat to its integrity.
Isn't that the truth?
Yep.
And that's what's happening with the ozone.
That's right. I had the opportunity once to discuss these issues about our future on the planet with one of the great physicists of the 20th century, Professor David Bohm, B-O-H-M.
Oh, and, wow.
And I, in a hallway conversation at a meeting once, I asked him, Professor, do you think we're going to make it? And he thought and thought, and finally he said, yes, Larry, we'll make it, barely. So, and then he gave me a big smile, and, you know, on some days I would settle for barely. I would be happy if we squeaked by, because on other days I think that we may not make it. But I think that the thing to keep our awareness on and focused on is that change is apace. It is going on. Consciousness is expanding in the sense of our understanding of our essential place in the environment, that we can't secede from it. And we just simply have to do, as individuals, everything we can to promote this growing consciousness and awareness.
I agree with you. And, you know, your book is so powerful, and it is so it's so full of light. There's a loving, compassionate energy to it, and I think it inspires people to pay it forward. And I thank you for all your wonderful research and your sharing with us, with your scientific background and your humanitarian background. And we're coming to the end of our call, Dr. Larry. Do you want to tell folks how they can get your free gift?
Well, I wish they would visit my website for the gift. It's LarryDosseyMD.com. Larry Dossey, D-O-S-S-E-Y, LarryDosseyMD.com. And you can click for a free gift, which is the first chapter of the book. It sort of lays out much of what we've been discussing. And recommend it to your friends. This is, I hope, my gift to humanity. It's been a joy to write, and it's just chock full of people's experiences. It's a very human read, and it's an easy read, and I hope an inspiring read.
Well, thank you once again, Dr. Larry. And can folks email you if they have if they want to share anything?
They sure can. There's actually an email I would share with them is this, Larry Dossey. Larry at DosseyDossey.com. That's Larry at DosseyDossey.com.
Fantastic.
There's two Dosseys because my wife and I share a website, and so
that's
how two Dosseys. It's not an ego trip. I didn't need to.
It's like giddy up, Dossey. Dossey, Dossey.
That's right, yeah.
Well, thank you once again, Dr. Larry, and you'll probably be getting some emails from folks because this has been a fabulous conversation, and thanks for all that you're doing for us.
Well, I send you the very best, Anna.
Thank you.